you want that?
You want two?
Nope.
Get a, yeah. Thank you.
So, we're supposed to chant something? An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with. Thousand million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of Tathagata's words. Thank you all for coming today and practicing and sharing your practice with me. I've been thinking about what to say. I sort of know the area I want to circle around in. And they begin with, or it begins with what we call Zazen. And it's too simple for us to believe, pretty much. That sitting still, paying attention to our posture, and breathing is the source of everything. I guess I should spring for an iPad so I don't have to be flipping things open. Mm-hmm. The air. For the Navajo, then, the air, particularly in its capacity to provide awareness, thought, and speech, has properties that European alphabetic civilization has traditionally ascribed to an interior, individual, human mind or psyche. Yet, by attributing these powers to the air and insisting that the winds within us are thoroughly continuous with the wind at large, with the invisible medium in which we are immersed, the Navajo elders suggest that that which we call the mind is not ours. It's not a human possession. Rather, mind, as wind, is a property of the encompassing world, in which humans, like all other beings, participate. One's individual awareness, the same sense of relatively personal self or psyche, is simply the part of the enveloping air that circulates within, through, and around one's particular body. Hence, one's own intelligence is assumed, from the start, to be entirely participant with the swirling psyche of the land and undue harm that befalls the land is readily felt within the awareness of all who dwell within that land. And thus the health, balance, and well-being of each person is inseparable from the health and well-being of the enveloping earth and terrain. The blessing goes, with everything having life, with everything having the power of speech, with everything having the power to breathe, with everything having the power to teach and guide, with that, in blessing, we will live. This is the nature of the interdependence that Buddha's realization is. I and all being is all being. It's the one thing that interdependence is, the transversal, if you will, that cuts through all of Buddhism and all of realization. It's what we study and what we awaken to. Now, we jump to the Lakota Sioux. And this was from a man named John Fire Lame Deer. Wonia Wakan. Wonia Wakan, the holy air which renews all by its breath. Wonia, Wonia Wakan, spirit, life, breath, renewal. It means all that. Wonia Wakan, we all together don't touch, but something is there. We sit together, don't touch, but something is there. We feel it between us as a presence. So I think those of us who've said Sesshin together particularly have felt this presence, this awareness, this breathing. You know, we literally breathe with the trees and the ocean. We literally breathe the pollen and the chemicals, what we call chemicals, that the trees and the ground exude. Literally, in the tantric sense, we are earth, air, wind, fire, water, and wood. So, the nature of Zazen, simply learning to sit up straight, our weight on our sits bones, our shoulders over our pelvis, our chin in a slight bit. It's so funny, I think I've given Zazen instruction for 44 of the 45 years I've been practicing. And it's quite remarkable. It's very, it's so simple. So chin in a slight bit, not too tightly in, but not up like this. Our eyes at about a 60 degree angle, open at a soft gaze, not focusing on anything in particular, but alert and aware our hands relaxed in our laps, fingertips touching. Tip of the left hand, fingertips touching the base of the right hand, and fingertips, thumb tips slightly touching, centered on our navel but slightly below it. Our ears over our shoulders, and a sense of rise from the top of our head. Heaven, earth. And we're sort of like the filament in a light bulb that connects the heaven and the earth. When we learn over time, it's been described as when our posture finds us. So we exert quite a bit of effort sitting zazen, trying to sit up straight, trying to hold ourselves seemingly some way or another. And all this struggle and effort goes on for some time. It's sort of exo effort. We're holding ourselves up with our muscles, with our arms, you know, we're like this. And what we find over time is, especially in the sesshin, that this isn't the smartest approach. In fact, we begin to sort of crumble. You know. Our will can't stand. At some point, we give in to who we are and how we are. And however minimal or max that is in our particular situation, or max, we stop pushing against. And we join with our life. And largely because we're forced to. If we want to keep our face and stay with the agreement we made to sit with people in a room for X number of days, of course we can always leave. Once in 1972, my teacher then, Dick Baker, was the abbot of the Zen Center, and he wrote the foreword to Huey Newton's little book. And he had taught Huey Newton how to meditate in prison when he was in, I think everybody was, but it's particularly him, in solitary confinement. And he brought him down to visit us at Tassajara. And the one thing I remember of what he said was, you know, I don't understand you people. They have to lock me up in the prison, and you have chosen to do this. Yeah. So a little bit, you know, the discipline of being on this rectangular cushion, the discipline of being present to the reality of our life, whatever we are creating right here on this cushion. And as you all well know, we create quite a lot. The suffering of our body and our mind as we're sitting here, and we might look down and, my gosh, I'm just sitting here on a cushion in a room. On a cushion. I'm wearing clothes. It's relatively warm. Why do I feel like I'm being chopped to pieces? Why do I feel like my back is going to explode? What's happening here? Who's making this up? After all, we're going to get breakfast, lunch, and dinner, tea with cookies. There's incense, there are flowers. What's going on here? What's going on? So maybe for some long time, the first aspect of zazen is settling. Just settling. In Chiantai Buddhism, they call it, even in earlier Buddhism in India, they call it shamatha. in China they called it, I think they called it, what was it? Oh, I can't remember the terms, but there are two. There's shamatha and vipassana. One is insight, but first there's shamatha, which is the settling and clarifying. And much of zazen for the first couple of years is settling. We don't know how unsettled we are. The only thing that I like to compare it to is often when you get a tall glass of water from the faucet and you make it go fast and it's aerated and it's sort of airy and grayish, then you set it on the counter for a little while and it clarifies, it settles and clarifies. So the second part of the deal is to come true, vipassana. Generally, we have to have shamatha, settling. I think it was called Tian and Quan in Chinese. And the settling is actually, can be, you know, it's difficult because we're accustomed to knowing something. We're accustomed to something happening within a rate of time of, I put this amount of effort in, I expect this amount of return. We wander through life not even knowing what a net present value equation is, and yet we function as though we are one. And we're not getting the best return. We are mining ourselves the same way we strip mine the mountains in West Virginia. And we're devaluing ourselves in the same way. And settling is coming to terms with this. Coming to actually experience how we're strip mining ourselves. How we're devaluing ourselves and how that has affected our lives. And not only how it's affected our lives, but how it's affected the trees, if not our children and our spouses and our mothers and our fathers. But when we live in a society where this is the culture, though, and it's hard not to do anything else. It's hard just to stop. You know, it's a culture of automatic transmissions. Put it in drive and go. The only way to stop is put the brake on. We don't know anything about clutches, disengaging, space, the space to feel. We don't know about the integration of gears. We don't know about timing and space. We don't know about when to be quiet and when to speak. We all have a position that needs to be heard. And we're all mostly willing to argue to establish our position. It's hard to learn about no position. Or, in fact, I would say, our very exact position. Our very exact position in this 3x3 rectangle, and the little cushion, and our butt, and our shoulders, and our breath. As we settle, we literally settle into our body. And slowly, when we give up on the exo portion of this and what it looks like, do I look okay? Good. That person must be enlightened. Look at their posture. When we give up on what we look like and where we want to go, from the inside out, we begin to settle. and our posture, our body comes to us. Whatever it is, it's each our own unique body. It's like we are bilateral, but we're not symmetrical. And that's really a hard one. Most people think we're symmetrical. In our mind, we're symmetrical. In reality, we're not. And this is like our relationship with the world, with other things, with trees and walls and cars and other people. So we settle into our bilateralness. The difference of our right cheek and our left cheek, of our right nostril and our left nostril, our right eye and our left eye, all of this. The great settling. And in that process, we begin to become subtly aware, more and more subtly aware of the internal complexity of our body, the relaxing of our intestines, the relaxing of our lungs, the pains in our shoulders, the connection between the nerve and our hip and our shoulder. Our fingers and our feet. You know, it sounds crazy maybe to tell people, to say, oh, what's that about? What do your lips feel like? What do your lips feel like at this very moment? Where does the moisture stop on our lips as it meets the air? What's saliva production taste like? Or dry mouth? Or how does your tongue feel? For the Chinese, the characters for poetry are heart and tongue. The tongue in Chinese healthcare, traditional Chinese medicine, is connected to the heart. So when your TCM doctor looks at your tongue, they're looking at your heart. Now, it's not exactly our physical heart that they're looking at. In fact, it's some combination of energy between our kidneys and our heart that they're dealing with, which is somewhere over here. It's an interesting little thing. But they have a true sense of the interconnectivity of the body and its resonance throughout. So there's this essay by a guy named Fujita, the Reverend Fujita, who is a Soto Zen priest, that says, Zazen is not meditation. And what exactly does he mean by that? For those of us who practice Zen, Zazen is bigger than meditation. Zazen is bigger than us. More is happening than I know at this very moment, sitting here. And over time, Zazen, the effort to sit Zazen, is doing more than we can even imagine. It's working on us. And then one day, 3 or 6 years later, or 25 years later, we were like, wow, this isn't anything like what I imagined it to be. What am I doing here? But this is pretty good. I really didn't want to open my heart. Or I wanted to open it only in the way I wanted to open it at the time I wanted to open it. So that I was in control. I used to describe Zazen as open heart surgery without anesthesia. And it's quite remarkable how just sitting up, even one doesn't have to sit cross-legged, one can sit in a chair and sit up like this, and if one can, with our shoulders over our pelvis, not, you know, Captain Courageous or whatever, or Captain America, just sitting up with our shoulders over our pelvis, just a slight open chest and a relaxed belly as best we can. How much we want to go. And how much we talk from here. How much we're protected. It's either Captain America or it's who are you, dear? You know, it's not relaxed. It's not accepting. There's an instrument, what's it called? Oh, come on, John. It's wonderful. It's a Tibetan religious implement, actually, but it's like an axe, a furba. And it has a blade. And I used to imagine it like just cutting open the chest, you know. Or like a friend of mine in his 70s who does this. He was adopted by the, I won't even remember the tribe, a tribe of Indians. He, as a young man, he went with the program that Kennedy started, Something America, where he worked on an Indian reservation in the Northwest in Washington when he was in college, and he decided to stay there for his life, and now he was accepted into the tribe. He's an elder and so on. And he went out to a powwow in Alberta or somewhere in the plains, and he did that thing where they have the big pole and they hang from their chests on the rope. To some degree, Zazen's a little bit like that, except it's not as dramatic, right? It's not as what's the word we've been using, Tom? We've been talking about
proprioception.
No. About being visible or not being visible. Okay. Anyway, it's not as exhibitionist. We'll put it that way. Zazen, like who knows what's going on in the person next to you, and yet it takes great courage for nothing to go on and everything to go on. And it takes great appreciation of one another. And we encourage one another greatly by being aware of the effort that we're putting forth to stay up straight. And breathing the air. Breathing with the trees, staying alive, teaching. Let's see if I can find this other piece. It's a little story. It's a portion of a story, actually. A portion of a Zen story by a famous man, famous Zen person named Dongshan. Dongshan is one of the founders. There are two founders of what's called Soto Zen today, Dongshan and Sao Shan. So, Sao Shan is the So, and Dongshan is the To. So, To. So, Dong. So I have a little forward to this piece. Bone breathing. So literally, we don't just breathe through our nostrils. Literally, like when we bathe, water gets in through our skin. Our entire being breathes. Zazen is waking up to this breathing. So bone breathing, ice dissolving, tree breathing, softening into spring. Can you hear it now? How dumb are we? Returning to Dong Shan's story, when he finally arrived at Yunyan, a famous Zen teacher, after leaving Guishan, another famous Zen teacher, he asked, and this is around 980 CE, he asked who was able to hear the Dharma expounded by non-sentient beings. Yunyan said that no sentient beings are able to hear it. When asked if Yunyan could hear it, he told Dong Shan that if he could, then Dong Shan could not hear him. Then Dong Shan asked why he could not hear it. Yunyan raised his fly whisk and then asked Dong Shan if Dong Shan heard it yet. When Dong Shan replied that he could not, Yunyan said, "You can't even hear when I expound the Dharma. How do you expect to hear when a non-sentient being expounds the Dharma?" So this all sounds very funny because we're looking at it from a certain perspective. We're looking at it like non-sentient being. For all we know, the water's a non-sentient being. Yet it's keeping this alive. And the cup's working. But we're making sense, trying to make sense of this. But in the Zen world, well, people think, this is why I make these talks so confusing. People think when they come to a Zen talk that they're going to get information. And we know what information is. And we know how to use information. Raising a whisk, breathing together, sitting here, is preaching the Dharma, is the teaching, is the speaking. The cup is speaking. The water in the cup is speaking. We're interrelating. The cushions are speaking. One of my, well, actually, relative, not early jobs, but a job a little later that one gets in a monastery when the odds, the lottery rolls, is something called anja. Japanese word. So I was the anja to the abbot, which meant I took care of the abbot's physical space, robes, toilet bowls, books, tea bowls, incense, whisks, made sure everything was where it's supposed to be when, served tea to people that came to visit, that type of thing. And what I was taught people think in Zen, you keep things clean and neat and orderly. And from some Western view or maybe some Protestant view or some view of efficiency, something like that. But what I learned, what I was told actually, which was a great teaching, is Just that the place is clean is not of interest. What's of interest is that you have contact with everything in the room. And you have relationship with it. And you take care of it. From the toilet bowl to the fancy old cases for super ceremonies. Without much distinction. Of course, you don't bring the old case into the toilet. But, and you wash your hands after working in the toilet. But the idea was, even if the toilet was clean, you cleaned it. You said hello. So that the space came alive. In Japan, they have a word for special trees, spirit trees, kami trees, K-A-M-I, and that's a Shinto thing. And these great trees, you know, we could probably locate one or two out here that we feel, you just feel their presence. You know, I work on the campus at Wellesley and College up there in Massachusetts, and there are a couple of just incredibly beautiful old oak trees with these incredible trunks and branches going out and around, and you can't help but just like, wow. There was a tree that sat in a field in Carmel Valley. And for three or so years, I lived down the Carmel Valley, about 22, 23 miles. And then you turn right for 16 miles on a dirt road, and over a couple of ridges and down in. And there was this tree as we rode up, I'm trying to remember the, might have been County Road 16. At any rate, towards Carmel, about a third of the way, on somebody's ranch, there was this live oak tree out in the middle of the field. And it just had this incredible shape. And it was like this just powerful being sitting there that drew people's attention. That drew our, like, whoa. And we used to refer to it as the tea bowl. It was like this, something like a beautiful handmade Raku T-ball out there in space. So there are just these beings in nature, you know, that are alive. After we would have our formal meals at the monastery, we would chant, of course, throughout the meal at different times. And at the closing chant, we would offer some portion of our food to the spirits, and then they would be, people would come around and collect those offerings, and they were offered to a tree out in the compound somewhere. The Metta Sutta came about as a teaching from Buddha because, so the story goes, so the rainy season was over, and what had become now in these later days has become what's called training periods, the period where monks and nuns gathered to practice in a garden in a somewhat urban area, was over, and then the monks traditionally go out and nuns traditionally go out to do their practice in some grotto or cave or along a stream somewhere or so on. And these three monks went off, and they were somewhere relatively close to one another, a grotto, a stream, and a tree, and they were sitting, and everything was upset. The feeling was upset. The animals weren't friendly. The birds weren't friendly. The village people didn't give them any sustenance to carry on their practice. The tigers were growling at them. So they were nervous, and they went back and talked to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, you should practice metta, loving kindness. And then he gave them the Metta Sutta for them to go back and practice the Metta Sutta. And they practiced the Metta Sutta, loving kindness, and that everything slowly changed. All of a sudden, the birds in the trees and the tigers and the villagers became friendly with them and started helping to support them. You know, bring them some milk or just leave them alone. Not be so angry with them, not so cold. And the vibe changed. So part of this settling, which is so hard for us, is actually, in a sense, practicing the Metta Sutta with ourself. Loving kindness with ourself. Loving kindness for the places we can't go. Where our breath stops. Acceptance of our blindness. Acceptance of our dark spaces. Not only acceptance, but in a sense, respect. They exist for a reason. And like the Metta Sutta, until we become aware and friendly with the reasons and respectful, they're hard. So we breathe, and it, you know, everybody tells you you're supposed to breathe in your belly, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's really simple. Just sit up straight and relax your belly. You know, just let that large intestine go. But we're so gnarled up inside, it's almost impossible, we think. So, respect, gratitude, and loving kindness with the air, breathing, settling. And as we settle, and that loving kindness goes down into us, just like the Metta Sutta, what happens is it's like compost that goes into the earth and creates rich humus that then comes back up and radiates like a flower. Not an easy passage. But the transformation of that energy and waking up to it is what this settling is about. And then as our posture finds us, as we settle, we begin to rise. And what do we rise with? We rise with breath. Even if we rise with breath for 30 seconds, it's a new world. And it gives us an inkling of what might be possible as an experience of life. In this posture, as we unite with breath, our entire sense field, our perceptual field, begins to awaken. Our skin, our muscles, from the tips of our toes to the tops of our heads, begin to open and relate. Our hearing and our eyes unite. Our sense of smell, our sense of space. And we begin to have some sensibility about what Dogen
says when he talks about body and mind falling away. The body and mind that falls away is not this body. The body and mind that falls away is the one that we hold, that we have, we conceive, that actually restrains our experience of the world and one another. So as we settle, and as our cheeks let go, and our lips let go, and our belly lets go, and our thighs and our toes, we might say we forget what we look like. It doesn't even matter anymore. We're just this experience occurring. And we meet the face before our mother was born. But this face is just the face before conception, before the restraint of projection and conception, that we're afraid to let go of our symmetry into our bilateral asymmetry. You know, it's a little bit like cubism after, I don't know that it was realism. What was the period? Impressionism? But before that, there was sort of more realistic representations. Or maybe how, the names are falling away. But at any rate, how all of a sudden our face, our body is different. You know? And this is okay. But for most of us, you know, we walk around and people are looking at how to hold their face together to look somewhere. I mean, what do we go to the beauty parlor for? What do we get haircuts for? How do we buy the clothes we buy to look like? Are they an expression of this? Or some imagined person we want to be? Or we think we need to be with other people? So that type of work is what goes on here together, and certainly it's a Sheen's in Zen monasteries, where we seep into one another behind the scenes of our projected idea of who we think we are. And the other day, 2 weeks ago, I was at a conference at Harvard Divinity School. It's kind of funny. It was about bringing compassion to institutions. but that's very funny. But I, being that I work in an institution.
What kind of
institution? Oh, prisons, you know, those friendly places. universities, hospitals. They weren't talking about financial institutions. But it would be good, you know. Where? It was at Harvard Divinity School. So anyway, I'm walking down the hallway. Actually, I was walking down a set of stairs to the toilet. And I hear this woman's voice. Kotatsu! Kotatsu! What's this? She said, I'd know the back of that head anywhere. And this is a woman I knew in 1983 that I hadn't seen since then. And it was wonderful to make this contact. But but she knew the back of my head. And I knew her at the moment. You know, we knew one another's bodies in a way. The space, the relationship. It's like, oh, yeah. And we said, how the strange ways we know one another. But this is the type of access that to our lives, to settling into our lives, to settling into our own body that makes it's possible and amazing. It's not like we spent 30 some odd years or 40 years, however long it was, missing one another or even thinking about one another. It's that the moment that something appeared, it was real. There it was. So, if ever anybody asks you why you sit zazen, it's okay to say you have no idea. Sorry. But let's see if we can find one more. Space and time. Let's see what we do with that one. Oh, yeah. Space / time. When Dogen came back from China to empowered to teach Zen and bring Zen to China, to Japan, people asked him what he learned in China. And he said, eyes horizontal, nose vertical. Now, cryptic, eh? Cryptic, unless you know vertical and horizontal. The physical space-time of zazen and being a human being, standing up, lying down, and being present to that. Then he wrote another essay, Japanese name Uji, translated in a couple of different ways, one being time, and the other for the time being. My favorite one, having been a fan of Husserl and Heidegger, was being time. Literally, that we are time occurring. That we're not a measurement of 5 minutes. That someone might describe 5 minutes of us, but our actual life is that 5 minutes being. Our heartbeat, our blood, our flesh, the sky, the change in light, all of this is being time. So then he also is famous for, actually it's his teacher, Ru Jing, Tiantong Ru Jing, Dogen's teacher, about body and mind falling away. And what body and mind falls away. It's like the exoskeleton of a bug. Sorry, I can't be more technical. You know, when it leaves and it goes to another, a new body, it molts. We're molting our constrained conceived. Falling away. And we're molting this individual mind that we perceive as separate. So then, as Dogen always says. He doesn't say it this way. He says, you should thoroughly examine this. I say, we should examine this. We should thoroughly examine this. But we should thoroughly examine this. And what does thoroughly examine mean? It's different for each of us. Okay. So now we move on to David Abram in a book called The Spell of the Sensuous. It is evident, however, that when our awareness of time is joined with our awareness of space, space itself is transformed. Space is no longer experienced as a homogeneous void, but reveals itself as the vast and richly textured field in which we are corporeally immersed.
In Navajo sand painting, just to bring us back to what you opened with, a work is constructed from every side, so it allows the vertical and horizontal to both be alive and to both be accessible. And it reminds me, when I've seen this only on video, when I've seen the healers or spirit people doing this, it's like they were dancing in that space. And a complete different relationship that their bodies have to it than one might have in mm-hmm. conventional, more yeah. conventional perspective or mm-hmm. painting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the nature of this ritual, that ritual practice, is literally entering time-space, literally leaving conceptual, leaving subject-object, sacralizing time rather than secularizing time. And in that space, interesting things occur. A lot of which is self-healing. So, like our friends, the Snu'oi, the Aboriginal tribe from Malaya that I was talking about last month, in that space of listening, one person can speak for the entire group. Because they are the entire group. And the inspiration at that moment is for that person to speak. Unlike the presentation in which my idea is better than your idea. Not a competition. It's a listening speaking. Something that actually Heidegger spoke a lot about. So, itself is vast and richly textured field in which we are corporeally immersed. This vibrant expanse structured by both a ground and a horizon. So, after you settle, and you will, in Zazen, there then becomes this long expanse. Well, first it actually feels pretty good. Wow, I'm settled. And my body's light. And I'm no longer fighting gravity. I'm no longer adding G-force to my life. Unnecessary G-force. And then it's sort of like, and at some point it might get quite boring, almost torturous, like you have to do something. Because, and it's at, through that boring field, crossing that desert, all of a sudden this texture opens. And this but reveals itself as this vast and richly textured field in which we are corporally immersed, this vibrant expanse structured by both a ground and a horizon. It's precisely the ground and the horizon that transformed abstract space into space-time, alive. We're in it. It's no longer about. And then, it's not boredom. Even nothing is vibrantly alive. And these characteristics, the ground and the horizon, are granted to us only by the earth. We can't experience them any other way. Thus, when we let time and space blend into a unified space-time, we rediscover the enveloping earth. It would seem then that the conceptual separation of time and space, the literate distinction between a linear, progressive time and a homogeneous, featureless space, functions to eclipse the enveloping earth from human awareness. As long as we structure our lives according to assumed parameters of a static space and a rectilinear time, we will be able to ignore or overlook our thorough dependence upon the earth around us. Only when space and time are reconciled into a single, unified field of phenomena does the encompassing earth become evident once again, in all its power and its depth, as the very ground and horizon of all knowing. And this isn't magical knowing, it's knowing about chemicals and worms. And the different properties of different types of soil. So this settling is making deep contact with the earth. It's making contact, all of our sorrows emptying into the earth. All of our difficulties, all of our hanging on to our body, our pains and our sorrows. And then returning, exhaling out, inhaling, rising, renewal, creation with each breath. Well, it looks like I've gone on for 63 minutes and 26 seconds. I think that's enough.
No.
Well, I could. The last time it was an hour.